Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. Friends, allow me now to introduce you to James Flaming Eagle Mooney, Elder and Seminole Medicine Man. How are you, my brother?
Hello, hello, everybody. This is your old friend Blue Otter coming to you from, where am I tonight? I'm not in the Rocky Mountains anymore. I'm not in Booger County in Missouri anymore. I am in East Tennessee, and our guest tonight is Robin Littlefeather Hannon. She's in the green room right now with Mark, and hang on a second. Let me see if they're ready to go. Hang on. They're not quite ready to come on the air yet, but listen, folks, if you'd like to call the show, the number to call in is 347-996-3318. That's 347-996-3318. Or you can Skype in by getting on Skype and clicking on the little S symbol next to the phone number. And we are on the air with Robin Littlefeather and Mark the Badger Borchetti. How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Oh, there's the badger. Yep. And I should have had a robin sound up here, but I wasn't on my toes tonight. But anyway, Robin's going to tell us about her book. And before we do that, Robin, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll have Mark do your Mayan birthday reading, and then we can get into your book. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me. Well, let's see, a little bit about me. I've been sort of a master of all kinds of different trades in my life. I've been in sales. I've been in public speaking. I've taught as a Reiki master practitioner. I've also done weddings. I'm ordained as a reverend, so I've done those as well. This book was a result of many, many years of lucid dreaming, and I'd actually shared it with many friends, and some of them were saying, this is something that you might want to reach out to others with. So I started compiling all these different things that I had done over the years, my journals, my thoughts, into this particular book. What else can I tell you? I have a wonderful family, a husband and two beautiful children and three wonderful grandchildren at this time. And I live here in Maryland.
Outstanding. And, I notice, does Linda Hunt have any, is she taller than you?
Linda?
You know who Linda Hunt is?
I have no clue.
The girl on NCIS Los Angeles. I noticed you are a little bitty person.
Yes.
And Well, yeah, yeah. I noticed that there was a picture of you next to somebody. I guess it was getting married, and you're a little tiny little thing. So I guess, that's where you come with little feather.
Yes, and, exactly. That's exactly right.
And well, we won't ask you, you know, how tall you are, how much you weigh, anything like that.
Well, about 5'2" last I looked.
Oh, oh my gosh, that bride you were standing next to must have been very tall.
Well, to me, everyone's tall. I'm constantly looking up at people, so yeah.
Okay. Anyway, no, I just thought I'd give you a hard time. But anyway, yeah. Have you been able to take a look at her data yet for her Mayan birthday?
Oh, yes.
What do you got for us?
Well, we'll do a couple components, and also I looked up, since she had something about tubers, her near-death experience, we're going to do that one, too. So we'll have two of them for her. This will get a little bit. This will be quite a bit of things to go over, maybe. But
great.
So the first thing we'll do is her birth, and in the traditional Mayan day count, she was born on a day called 11 Chacon, and it has serpent energy. The 11 has to do with things about testing, especially test and. Payments and tributes and things of that nature on the psychic and the mental order, especially testing in order to be able to transmute and work with knowledge. So, and that knowledge would tend to be related to development of cosmic things, energies, and powers like that, life force and things of that nature. So, she might also have some eagle energy floating around too, because this is the 11th day of the eagle cycle. So that's in the traditional Mayan day count. And switching gears, I go over into the Six Sun Zulkin, and we have three readings for her. And because of her NDE, this might make some sense to her, because we'll be going through three components: a forward flow of time, the way we normally think of time, a backward flow of time coming from next world cycle into us, and where these two come together, a zero point or a unity point. So on her forward flow, her birth has things that she may have seen carrying along her life since birth. It's things about awareness, flourishing, working with creation, a lot of warrior and condor energy. These have to do with fearlessness, reason, and justice. So things like that may have, you know, shown up as being important in her life. On the other flow, coming back, she has something that I think is going to probably relate, also connect, because it's coming back to her, NDE, or near-death experience. And here she has the energy of change, synchronicity, things that have to do with movement and thought, and that movement and thought is in accordance or strongly tied to a power of love, but not just any old power of love. It's never-ending, eternal. It has aspects of waking up, prophecy, and things about having balancing comes up here. So that is something I know I've heard, you know, people bringing up in near-death experiences, aspect of love and knowledge and wisdom, which we're seeing sort of both of those here. Now, where these two come together at that zero point, the two time flows mix, she has a glyph here that has to do with the sun. And it has to do with things about enlightenment, molding, shaping life, firing things, getting courage, again, coming back into working with aspects of creation and creating, things like that on a, you know, all levels, especially when that creation and creative ability is pulling in aspects of wisdom, free will, opening up pathways, she probably may have an ability here to work with time. You know, if she looks into the Central and South American stuff, she may find some connections with Jaguar energy. She may want to look at the Temple of Quetzalcoatl and the Pyramid of the Sun and the whole thing at Teotihuacan in Mexico. Also, I think she probably wants to look a little bit at the Mayan city of Palenque. That probably has some things for her as well.
Wow.
Yeah, ain't he something?
Well, you don't know how many accurate things he just hit. That's pretty amazing. First of all, yes, you're correct in terms of the eagle energy. That's very, very big in my life. And as a matter of fact, in my book, there's something called Eagle Dreams that speak of some of these energies. And yes, a lot of snake medicine, very right on the money. Also about jaguar medicine, absolutely. We call jaguar Choco Chinchai, and very much so. It has been walking through that jaguar medicine, the way of death, almost into the light. So, yeah, that's pretty right on the money. Most of the things that he talked about. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, now we'll take a look and we'll look at your second birth, your near-death experience. I think this is the first on the show, right, Blue Water? We haven't done a near-death experience date.
That's right. So
this will be.
And when you get a chance, shoot me her birth date on Facebook, and I'll run her Hebrew reading.
Okay. All right. Just a second. I'll get that to you.
What we'll
and
do
just
is
as a little by-the-by, I've been more or less trained and brought up more in the Yanomami tradition, and a lot of that is very similar to Mayan thought. So bringing up those Mayan ideas, they are very, very similar. The parallels are really quite astonishing.
So we're going to look up your near-death experience date here now. We'll see what that shows. So on that day, and the Mayan traditional day count was a 12 sib, or 12, it's condor energy. And it's the 12th day of the Chacon cycle, that serpent energy. So these two are working with each other.
Yep.
And it has condor energy of the south, and then the serpent energy, and then the eagle energy we saw before was the north. So we have the prophecy of the condor and the eagle, where the two come together, the north and the south come together. So your near-death experience seems to be leaning a little bit more into the condor energy of the south, which in their stories, the condor sort of symbolizes the heart, or the traditional, the family values, the native connections of family and relationship with everything. So it connects into that kind of stuff. So let's say your near-death experience is bridging that into the serpent energy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. Now, there's probably other things too, but that seems to be a big part of it. Yet, also is the 12 in it is an indicator of a spiritual catalyst, strong energy behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is... And it's also bringing up aspects of the testing again, especially things that relate to ability to forgive.
Oh, yes.
So,
yes.
So now we'll swing over and look at the sixth sun, Zulcan, and see what it says. And this is where we got the forward, backward in unity, or zero-point time flow. On the forward flow of time, guess what we have? same thing, the 12 sib or condor energy, exact same thing. That tells me that this near-death experience is actually operating in both time orders, or any way of looking at time, probably. So it's a very, it also anchors your near-death experience all the way back to your birth.
Mm-hmm.
So it indicates, it gives us a little bit more information about that in terms of it brings in a energy of manik or a healing hand energy. So there's a healing energy that's coming into focus here now. On the backward flow of time, we have one of the new glyphs of the next sun age, and it's a glyph that has to do with joy and forgiveness. There's
mm-hmm.
that forgiveness thing again. And soul. Obviously, that would connect into the near-death experience of yours, but it's bringing in aspects here of dimensionality and form and formation. It has a lot to do with partnering with the energy of peace here,
mm-hmm.
and a change or transformation into peace, and bringing up things like using a childlike nature and hope and things with that to bring in that joy and forgiveness and that peace. So, and so in the case you have an ability of kind of just naturally being there and having this kind of just happen around you, it'll just sort of fall into place, and it's a transmutational type change. You may see some things with skulls, or crystal skulls, or skull type symbolism showing up too here in the last few years. Anytime right before your near-death experience to right after it, you could have been seeing more of these type of aspects show up. And they're connected into heart chakra energy.
Mm-hmm.
So they also connect into, I don't know if in the traditional thing that you said that was similar to the Mayans, what the color green symbolizes to them, but if you go into the Mayan Popol Vuh Council book, when they're going through one world age to the next, they have a prayer in there. They don't mention any of the other colors of the medicine wheel except for the center color, and it's green. If you take I think of it as the Russians that found that there's a green frequency energy that's actually coming out of the top of pyramids. So that might be something that might be interesting to you as well. Maybe you even experienced something of that nature, during your near-death experience possibly too. Now, where these two come together, the condor energy and the green forgiveness energy come together, they form a day that talks about universal, all, everything. And it's talking about awareness of that, unifying it. That's a big aspect of here. So I would say as we move through this, and a big part of what you're probably going to be doing, and a big key for you to be able to move from one world cycle into the next and move from one area to the next and move across the door or bridge or whatever you want to call it, how you want to look at it, for you to move in that center for a zero point is unifying things,
mm-hmm.
bringing things together. And it's going to be pulling a little bit more on that condor energy, the stuff from the south, the tribal, native, family connection type energies.
Makes sense to me.
And it's going to be like a seed going into the ground.
Mm-hmm. And, all these things you're saying make so much sense. In terms of forgiveness, that has been something that not only am I walking out, and I choose to walk out, it is in my book. It's something I talk about because it's been an important thing that has been sort of drilled into me since 2000, that this is not just something that is a luxury, but a necessity. And the idea of transmutation and moving forward in this, and definitely the condor eagle energy has been a huge thing, and the transformative things have been very big since then. So all the things that you've said make perfect sense if you know what I've been through in the last, since 2000. It really is amazing how you've managed to take my journey and put it into these very clear, precise paths that are so serendipitous to what I've been actually going through. Hello?
Yes.
Yes, sorry.
I think it was trying to sense that. Hey. I was saying that Blue Otter didn't get something. I'm
one of you,
wrong.
I have my mic.
Blue Otter.
I have my mic off. I'm sorry.
I thought maybe it was my phone. I was like, uh-oh.
I had my mic off for a second. And hey, somebody shoot me her birth date. Okay, good deal.
I did.
Oh, my gosh. You're okay. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
My gosh, you don't. You certainly don't look my age. That's unbelievable. You're
good genetics.
My
mother was like this too. My mother was an incredibly beautiful, beautiful lady, and remained very youthful way into her late 60s, early 70s. So I've got some good genetics on that side of the family.
Interesting. When you want to start talking about your book?
Yes. Basically,
well, hang on. Before we do, I wanted to get everybody in the mood. There's a real special song that's been special to me for a long time, and it was written by Hoy Axton back in the 60s, and it's on his Microphone is On album. And since we're going to be talking about dreaming, I want to share this with you. It's a little bit under 3 minutes, and it's called Revelations. And I'll take you guys off mic for a few minutes. Here it is.
God, don't let me live my life in vain. Help me throw some sunshine on a world filled with rain. Help me help somebody. Help me help them see all the rainbows and the promises that you showed me. Please, God, don't let me live my life and die without ever even wondering why. Children laugh and lovers lie. Give me something to hang on to. Give me revelations. See the crystal mountains. Hear the rainbows falling. I can hear old Gabriel. I can hear him calling. Seven golden candlesticks, seven angels blowing silver horns, read it in the book of Revelation. I'm gonna be reborn. I'm gonna be reborn. And please, God, don't let me live my life in vain.
Yeah, that song has had a real long-lasting effect on me. I don't know if have you ever heard that song, Robin?
No, it's beautiful.
It is. You can you can get it on YouTube. Just put in Axton, A-X-T-O-N, and Revelations. And his mom wrote Heartbreak Hotel, believe it or not. And I don't know if you remember who he'd asked. Well, you probably do. You're that age bracket. And go ahead and go ahead. Oh, by the way, I had messaged you. You're born before or after sunset on the day?
It would be I think it's like either 1 or 1:30 a.m. So it'd be like an hour to an hour and a half after midnight. That would be before sunset.
Okay. Good deal. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, one other thing. On her birth is the thing we talked about the peace energy. That is actually the peace, joy, and forgiveness and all that. That is connected into the white buffaloes that were born in Janesville, Wisconsin.
No kidding.
Yeah, when you unify those two, Miracle and Miracle Second Chance, were the name of the two white buffaloes born there. When you unify their births, that connects into that forgiveness and joy and peace aspect of your birth. So that seems to be maybe an important component for you to maybe explore and look at in the whole thing with the white buffalo and the story of the white buffalo and white buffalo cattle and those two white buffaloes, because they seem to be a part of that aspect for you.
Wow, thank you. That's amazing. Just really bowled over by what you were saying, especially you were talking about there's that warrior part of me, and yes, that is very true of me. I use it in the path to pursue that peace, but that is there, the justice, the need for justice, the need for things to be right. So a lot of what you said, pretty amazing, pretty right on, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a lot of information to digest, I know. So, go ahead and tell us about your book.
Well, what my book was a series of many, many years of lucid dreaming and or of what we call vision quests, depending on what culture you're from, in which I had certain experiences and I basically journaled about these experiences. So in this book of lucid dreams, they are basically dreams that you're going to see through my eyes. And you have many, many different topics. You have some stories from the other side, meaning from people and places where people have died. There's a chapter on forgiveness, which, of course, we were just talking about, being the light. And what does that mean? A relationship with spirit. There are vision journeys to nature. There's a whole section on rebirth and renewal, which is very much about that snake energy transitions. And there's actually in transition something called snake journeys. And in the previous chapter, which is rebirth and renewal, there's something called eagle dreams. So you will see this is very much from my perspective. There's some soul journeys, what it means to be in the moment. There's a section in their fear versus faith, masculine and feminine divine, and what is harmful faith. Then there's a little bit about Reiki, what that is, and there's a collection of stories and some poems. And that's basically the book. And the book is designed to just kind of let me take you on this journey where I have seen things and look at it through my eyes and see what resonates with you in this little book. And what feels good to you and what witnesses to your own spirit. So that was more or less the purpose. Right now the book is in transition. It was called The Heart Song of Anekahi. However, no one knew what Anekahi was. Nobody could pronounce it. So I went back to the publisher. We're renaming the book. It's going to be called Vision on Fire. I think I'm not exactly sure when it's going to be out. So right now I have about 30 old copies of the Heart Song of Anekihi that I have to give out. And after that, it will be Vision on Fire, A Venture into Lucid Dreaming, and the cover will be changed. But the basic messages and all the things that were in the previous book are still there.
Outstanding.
What I thought I might do is talk a little bit about some of these things and see what piques your interest, whether or not you want to discuss stories from the other side, forgiveness, being the light, is some of these vision journeys to nature, rebirth, renewal, transitions. Is there one of these messages that you feel might speak to the people out there that we would be better off discussing or that you think would be germane?
Well, we've kind of been all about trying to teach people how to reproduce the experiment. So if there's anything you can, any advice you can give to people about how to develop this gift.
Well, that's, there were a couple of things.
Yeah, what process did you go through when you way back when?
Well, the first thing for me is breath work. In other words, in order to get into a place to do this, I have found that you have to have proper breathing because it relaxes the physical and mental body. And if you're not relaxed, it's very hard to get into a state where you're going to hear or see anything, let alone this kind of content. So for myself, I'm a singer. I'm familiar with breath work, and I use techniques of breath work and some Reiki movement and some Qigong and other things to get into a place where I'm feeling physically calm, because that's important. So that's one of the first things for me. I also have something monotonous in the background, whether it be a drum or a rattle or just something, because I find that, again, the monotony helps me to clear my mind and just get into this process. Now, in some of these cases, some of these were actual physical dreams, so I was actually dreaming. And in those cases, I've sort of trained myself to kind of go through the dream and wake up and write it down before I forget it.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I'm doing if it's an actual dream. In a lot of these, where I'm not dreaming, I try to get into this calm place. I'm listening to something that's kind of monotonous. I try to get my breath in sync with whatever beat there is. I'm just clearing my body, and I may, you know, tighten and loosen my muscles so that I know that I'm aware that my muscles are relaxed. And once I'm in this place of relaxation, I ask a question in my mind of what it is I want to know. Or sometimes something will just, you know, a topic will come to me to meditate on. So, for example, in the ones that were questions or vision journeys to nature, I had specific questions. One was question of Mother Earth, which said, you know, what's going on with us here at this time and place? Why is the weather going so crazy? So that was a question. And the answers were given to me in this calm place, and then, of course, you know, I have to get up once I'm done and try to write it down as quickly as I can to try to capture whatever answers have been given to me at that time, if that makes sense to you. There's also other things that I do that are maybe perhaps a little bit more cultural, but I would say certainly finding sacred space might be important, whichever way is good for you, you know, whether it be just a prayer or, you know, something that you physically do, but just, you know, keeping your space in a good sanctified way, you know, so that good things are going to come through without fear, you know, just your intent being, I want something good to come through. I obviously want the best possible thing that I could hear to come through, what's in my best and highest interest. So for me, I might do some things that would, you know, create space for me in that way, to sit with this. A lot of times I will make sure I haven't had something to eat. So if I know I'm going to do this, unless it's a dream, in which case I haven't prepared, but if I'm preparing for it, I may go on a water fast for a few days or something like that and make sure that there's nothing hindering me from hearing what I need to hear. So these are all techniques that I've used in terms of the how. And what I say to people is, what I've noticed is that this is very much about the person doing it. So what works for me may or may not work for another person, but there are certain things that are definitely universal, such as being in this calm place and being open to it and not second-guessing yourself. So whatever the first thing is I hear, that's what I'm going to write down, even if it sounds absolutely silly to me. And there have been times I've written something down and said, boy, this sounds ridiculous.
Very
important.
And then
important. Later on, it'll make sense.
Very important, yeah. It because a lot of this stuff that comes in, it might seem to people like it's a reverie, but it's really important to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Really important. And it's just like, both times, now I've been widowed twice, and both times I dreamt about an airplane crashing, and I didn't realize until after my first wife passed away that a dream of an airplane crashing is the dream of a death in the family. And and then about a year before my second wife died, the first wife died of cancer. Both of them were older than me. And my first wife's mom died at 51, and Joanne was 48 when she passed. And Betty was 12 years older, and she had a stroke. But before Betty passed, I dreamt of a fighter plane. It was an airliner with Joanne, but it was a fighter plane, and that fit Betty. You know, she enlisted in the Army. You know, and she was 29 when she did it, and she didn't even know she was going through the same basic that men were going through. So she was a fighter. But I dreamt that she's. It didn't auger into the ground. It skidded through five buildings before it finally came to rest. And that's exactly how many buildings, you know, the hospitals and emergency rooms and that she went through, you know, before she finally passed away. So dreams, there's a real language, and this is the language that Creator speaks to you, but you got to learn the language. Sometimes it's word. Sometimes it's word picture, like rebus. A lot of people don't know what rebus is, but it's word pictures. And square foot might be a square plus a foot. And you don't see it much anymore. But you got to look out for all kinds of stuff. And you need to keep diary. I recommend a cheap voice activated tape recorder by your bed. Even if you got it, you know, tie it on a string to the ceiling and dangle it over your, you know, a foot over your head so you can pick up anything that they're saying during the night. And, you know, because you might miss, you know, anyway, just some ideas.
No, those are really good ideas. And I do tell people, you know, keeping a tape recorder is a very handy thing. Like you said, voice activated. Just trying to get as much of that information as soon as you can. You know, try not to let it sit, because as the moments go by, as you well know, it's a fleeting thing. So you want to kind of get it while you still have it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's how I was able to do most of this. Just making sure that, you know, either I had something by my bed or some way of getting this out and down. And in some cases, it was during the day, so I was very well prepared because I had fasted or I had done my thing, and I was sitting down to ask these questions. So I had my tape recorder, and I had everything right, you know, my And for me, even though I have a tape recorder, I tend to like to write things. There's something about the physical writing for me that, that solidifies whatever I need. And then the tape recorder may fill in the gaps where, you know, I'm not writing quickly enough to keep up with whatever else is going on.
Okay. Hey, Mark, if you got any, you know, anything?
I was curious about one thing, and I think probably a few other people are that maybe read the Blog Talk Radio post about her, and that is how any of the experiences with your near-death experience where you were on the operating table and what happened kind of there, and you, I think you, there's something about how that maybe helped open up some of these thinking or thought process or understandings to you that may, since you went through that type of experience, there may be something in there that may be helpful to some other people to hear about.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is, and I tell people this all the time, for me it was transformative in that when I came back to me, there was a part of me that did not return. There's a part of me that not, that is still not, it's dead. What came back is the part that, that you're speaking to, the me now, the whole, I am still whole, but yet there was a section or part of me that was left in that realm, and I don't know how else to explain that, but what happened was that I've had serious back issues. This was a third attempt to fix these very bad issues in my back, and I was on the table. And, of course, you know, they put you out, and all of a sudden I hear this beeping, and I'm thinking, are we done yet? And I kind of looked around, and I'm seeing somebody on the table, and I thought, well, that's odd. What's going on? And there was a Ronda Liturka, I don't know if you know the Mozart pieces playing in the background. I think it was it. And I'm thinking, what? I don't understand. What is this? And I realized I didn't feel any pain. I'm like, well, gosh, they must have given me some good medication. You know, I don't feel any pain. So I'm just kind of just scratching my head, and I'm watching these doctors, and they're racing around this body, and the, you know, put this in and do that and do that and do that and do that. And all of a sudden I felt like a hand on my shoulder, and I turned around, and it was my grandfather. And, you know, my grandfather had passed quite a while back, and I saw him, and I thought, uh-oh, if I'm seeing my grandfather, that must mean I'm dead. I said, either that or they've given me, again, some wonderful drugs, I don't know which. And I'm looking at this, you know, man going, what just happened? And basically, he started to talk to me, and my life just kind of became very clear. All the things in the past, the present, the future, it was like everything about me that I could suddenly know that just was crystal clear. And you know, of course, now I don't remember all of it, but it just, in a moment of time, it was just my whole life. It was as clear as a bell. And we were, you know, sat there and kind of enjoyed each other. And then at one point he said, okay, you got to go home. So this is going to sound funny, and you'll laugh when I tell you, but it's the absolute truth. So he takes me to what looked like Coney Island, but of course it wasn't Coney Island, but it looked like Coney Island. And there was this roller coaster, and it was a wooden roller coaster. He says, okay, you got to get on the roller coaster. Well, if you know anything about me, I'm terrified of roller coasters. Never mind a wooden roller coaster. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, I'm not getting on that. Are you out of your mind? He said, you got to get on it. Oh, no, you don't. Robin, you got to get on the roller coaster. No, I'm not getting on. And, you know, this argument went on for a few minutes, and he said, I'm tired of arguing with you. He kind of grabbed my arm and shoved me in the roller coaster, latched me in, and gives it a good hearty push, and this thing went tumbling down, and there was a point where it reached me, my body, and it was like, whoomp, and there I was. back in my body, I guess, at that point. It was a very unique experience because I when I first came out of anesthesia, I thought, wow, that was a crazy dream. You know, I didn't know what to make of any of it. I said, oh, you know, whatever. But as I became more lucid and started to, I noticed there were changes in me that were profound. And I didn't know, I actually got kind of scared. I was like, what in the world is going on here? It was frightening at first. And some of these things that started to come to me were scary. These intense kinds of dreams that are related in the book, very vivid. And, you know, at first it's like, what? Oh, my gosh. You know, so I really didn't quite know what to make of it. It took quite a while for me to understand what this was and how to deal with it. And I guess for me, the first dream, which I didn't actually put in the book, but I was with my grandfather again, and I said, what do I do? And he said, you've got to learn to control these visions and dreams. These are being given to you for a reason. You got to start journaling about them and trying to understand what's going on here, not being afraid of this thing, you know. So it was at that point that I thought, okay, I better get on the ball and start understanding and learning about this and controlling it in a better way so that I can make sense of my world and of what was going on with me. So the first thing that I would say, at least for me in this time of near death, is it wasn't a long period of time from what I'm told, but yet it felt like forever. I mean, there's no sense of time, none. Time is completely irrelevant. That was the first thing I found in this place. There was no such thing. I didn't see any tunnel. I didn't see any light. Some people say they do. I did not. I do know that as I said, my life did become very crystal clear. All of the reasons I'd gone through, everything I'd gone through, where I'd been, why I'd been, where I was going, why I was going, what I'd be doing, everything. And it was like this big download. You know, if I were some sort of computer and got a mass download, that's what it kind of felt like to me. There was absolutely no sense of fear in this death thing. I mean, it was almost as though I had just woken up and I was looking around going, oh, here I am. So what I would say is that even though death seems frightening to us from our perspective, just from experiencing it myself, there was no fear involved in it at all. There was some confusion maybe as to what had just happened, but no fear. The other thing that it helped me to see is that there is more than just what we see to this life. There are things out there that we don't necessarily see and understand on a spiritual level that are beyond that veil. So that was important for me to really see and understand and experience. What I saw it as a gift. It was a gift. It was a new birth. It was the beginning of this process that the gentleman was talking about earlier that he just so vividly painted and put into perspective in terms of where I'd been and what I'd been experiencing. So what I found for this experience for me is it was an open door to something new in my life, to a gift that I want to share with others, to a hope that I can give to other people as well.
Oh, that's good. That's good, because people don't understand that this is available to them, and a lot of people today just don't believe because they don't have a conversation with the Creator, and if they grew up understanding that you could do this, this is applied science. It's not religion. It's not spirituality. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it's a technology that's been forgotten.
Yeah, that can make some sense. And, you know, in this world, people are afraid of what they don't understand.
Yeah.
So it's hard for them to believe it because they haven't seen it, they haven't tasted it, they haven't smelled it. It's not within their five sense realm, therefore it must not exist.
It's like Republicans and cannabis.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't speak to that.
Yeah.
I don't get into those politics.
I heard it described that there's kind of sensing, which are senses, like you said, are five senses. So there's that. And then there's also knowing. So we can sense something or we can know it. And my guess is that when you had your near-death experience and stuff, you were operating almost maybe 100% in the state of knowing versus just sensing something.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
No, it does, because everything, the knowledge was just so clear. And in my book, when I speak about some of these journeys and other dreams that I've had, most of them were dreams. There's one that was an actual vision journey, which I needed. There were two, one to my father and one to my mother, that I needed to take for myself for information. But most of these were interesting dreams in which I encountered things that have passed. Even one was about my dog, believe it or not. And the interesting synchronicities that happened with some of these journeys to sort of solidify the fact that there's more to what we see than what we see.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed anything about dreams you get on equinoxes and solstices?
Sometimes they get to be a little bit more dicey and intense. I have noticed that.
Yeah.
They seem to, it's almost as though there are certain phases, and I'm not sure what it is about those phases, whether it's the phases of the moon or, like you said, the equinox, this and that, where it's almost as though that veil is even more thinly parted, and
mm-hmm.
you can peek through more in those times. So
now
there does seem to be some of that.
The spring equinox of 98 is what I was told what the weather was going to be like in 2005. And which came true in space. And one thing I'd like you to be aware of is the elder that wrote the book on Mayan astrology taught my teacher, Robert, Three Eagles, that you can do your vision quest. It's called a Mayan vision quest, and you do it on your Mayan birthday, the center of night. What you do is you'll calculate, you know, from the time the sun goes down till it comes up, and the center of night. And if you feel compelled to go to a special place, that's fine too. But you make a circle, and you need to have a candle burning, and you need to have an object of the appropriate colors in each quadrant of the circle. And so if you could start being aware and calculating, you know, when your Mayan birthdays come up every 9 months or so, that's a real good opportunity to actually I found the best time to go out to cry for a vision.
Interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Well, I guess I'll have to calculate my Mayan birthday then.
Yeah, that's easy to do. Do you recommend any particular dream dictionary? I found them to be pretty important. Yeah.
Actually, for myself, I don't use dream dictionaries, but this is me. I have my own ability to interpret dreams.
Yeah,
so
I don't
need a dictionary.
Yeah, so after a while,
date,
you don't.
The next date for her that would be good to do that on is going to be August 18th, 2014.
Okay.
August 18th, you said?
I'm going to do it like Blue Otter says, my Envision Quest thing. It'd be August 18th, 2014.
So,
and I should do this midnight around.
Well, center of night, and depending on what time, you know, so sun's going to go down about 9:30 and come up probably about 7, whatever, 7. It's probably going to be like a 10-hour night, so it might be like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Something like that. Just kind of figure it out from get on weather.com and find out when the sunrise and sunset is, and it usually works out to be about 2 o'clock in the morning.
I'm definitely going to have to give that a try.
And, yeah, it's pretty intense. I had the first time I did it, I had a really intense experience. And it, you know, I was in Utah, and I was told, you know, that I was going to have to go back east, and I didn't have any choice. And that's exactly the way it worked out. I had no choice. I mean, the creator broke my car down in the place that I was supposed to be, and it was amazing the way it happened.
But, I've had those kinds of weird things happen where, you know, the synchronicity will make sure you're in a certain place at a certain time, whether you want to be there or not.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's
and
like,
it can get very interesting.
Oh, yeah, it can get very frustrating, you know. And
oh,
you,
yeah.
You look back to see, you know, that was a setup, and you really got to keep your head on a swivel when you start walking out and these kind of things. It becomes a real journey. And but yeah, you might want to take a look at that Hebrew reading I did for your near-death experience, because it's all about being a priest. And,
I definitely am going to take a look at that.
Yeah,
that was really quite phenomenal and very enlightening. You know, especially the idea of the constant testing that you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
And yes, I would say since 2000, that has been a constantly being tested. Constantly, you know, things will come my way where I'm like, oh no, not again. You know, and that. Where I'm being tested on something, you know, did you learn it? Are we going to go through this again? That kind of thing. And you're sitting there going, oh, boy, all right.
Yeah. Well, that reading for your near-death experience, PASSO, PASSO, it's all about keeping yourself undefiled, which is really important if you really want to do this, you know, to be worthy or whatever. You really need to keep yourself as undefiled as possible, and you know, and go by the spirit on as far as that goes. You're not under the Sinai covenant, so you don't have to go through all that stuff that they do. But it's a really important to have a good life, and don't, you know, cheat people, steal from people, and just be a reprobate
Well, you know, and that's part of my book, by the way. I talk about what it means to be the light and how important that is. That you know, everything that we say, everything we do is a choice. And yeah, you're right. I have to keep it clean. I have to keep it on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that means walking in the way that I know to walk, not in this, you know, the way we all have our shadow selves. It's very easy to get pulled into walking into that part of ourselves because we're all human and we all have those desires. But the thing that has come to me over these many years and certainly through my dreams and in my visions is, no, I can't do that. If I'm going to be a light worker, I can't do that. I have to keep choosing to be in the light. And what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So. Very important.
Yeah, a lot of people nowadays, they don't have a clue what that means. And you know, depending on how you were raised and, you know, what your parents', you know, level of tolerance were, you might have to make some real adjustments, you know.
Well, yeah, and it's usually going to really tweak whatever belief system you have. Whatever you think you know, you probably don't.
Oh, absolutely. It's just like the people that actually do the translation work on ancient scriptures. They, you know, what do they call those people? I can't remember what they're called, but
they usually have nothing to do with the religionists, you know. But I find that once this process gets going in you, you kind of become addicted. You want it so bad that in order to get it, you've got to jump through certain hoops to continue to get it, because it's a comfort, and it's a way to continue to know that you're validated by the Creator and that you're doing okay. And but it's one book of scripture likens it to keeping your hand on a horizontal, like a banister or a rail or a rod, but you're going through a mist of darkness. And you know, you might encounter, you know, a large building with a lot of people laughing at you and mocking you, but you just gotta keep going toward this brilliant tree of life, and just keep going.
It wouldn't be the first or the last time I've been laughed at, but my grandfather always used to say, "Let them laugh. You just be who you are. Don't worry about what people laugh at." And that's how I see it. You know, I'm going to just walk my path, and if you laugh, okay. Enjoy.
Yeah. And it's
hope
really
you have a good time laughing, but it's not going to stop me from where I'm going or what I need to do.
And it's real important to stay humble, too, because, you know, you got this gift. If you start getting, example, Sylvia Brown. She started getting, you know, quite arrogant, and she, over a period of time, lost her gift, and it was so gradual that she didn't even notice it was happening. And
you do have to be careful, because that's the shadow side of ourselves, and we all like our back to be patted, and we all have ego, so it's very hard sometimes to stay out of the way of that human ego and keep going. You know, I know for myself, I just have to pull myself short and go, "Hey, come on now. You're learning like everybody else. There's nothing so unique about you under the sun."
Mm-hmm.
You have to just keep yourself in that humble place, you know, and move forward, and not feed the ego-centric part of ourselves. It's easier said than done.
Oh yeah.
But it is possible. You just have to watch out for it.
Well, it helps to have a little bit of ego, or else, you know, you'll never get yourself out there. But to move to being a mania, or, you know, becoming tyrannical, because I don't know, I've hung around a lot of different rules groups, and I noticed, when I was hanging around with one particular group, I noticed that particularly women like to use this to control men. You know, well, I think, you know, God wants us to do this, God wants us to do that. and the guy was just kind of clueless. And it was pretty easy to lead a guy around by the nose. That gets real old real fast. And it's not right.
You want your partnership to be a partnership, not a dictatorship.
Right.
Either way, whether it's a man or a woman.
Right.
And a lot of these things are things that it's interesting that we're going over, because these are things I'm absolutely talking about in this book that you will see over and over in everything that I'm talking about. That, you know, we have to really watch ourselves if we want to be a person of spirit. We have to watch our motives and why we're doing something, and respect the person that we're with, you know. And these are all important things to note when we're on this journey. We don't just go and do what we feel like doing, and that can be a very hard thing to let go of, because we all want what we want, on that human level. There isn't any of us who don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's something I talk about, you know, in terms of what does it mean? What does it mean? How are we going to be this light? And what are we, how do we act, and how do we behave? And what's
I know one of the Hopi elders, Grandfather Martin, one of the things he always really pretty strongly suggests, a word that he uses quite a bit, is he says, stay noble. That's the way he says it.
I'm just going to read something I think that's pertinent to this, and it's in my book. It's called Being the Light. Has anyone noticed that all it takes is one small lit match and darkness disappears? By the same token, all it takes is for us to shine our own light for darkness to flee. How do we be that light, and what do we need to do? For me, and this is my own experience, being the light means a few things. It means as much as possible I want to submit myself to Spirit each day. I want to keep open to whatever it is that I am meant to do on that day that will edify, uplift, and help others. In order to be the light, I see myself in a continual evolution. I am imperfect. I reside in an imperfect body. Like any other person, there is my shadow self to deal with. And I think that that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's part of the thing we're going over with the warrior thing that you picked up on earlier in your reading. The warrior energy of, and the warrior has to go in there and fight within themselves, you know, and keep an eye on what you're talking about there, the shadow energy, and then they let the light out and they wrestle around with the darkness inside of them. Maybe.
Well, you know, for me, what the worst thing is about being a warrior, if I'm going to say there's one horrible thing that I do not like about being a warrior, it's that a lot of times I'm called to be in a position where if there's something going on that's not good, I'm the one to find it. I feel like one of these metal detectors, except I'm not detecting metal, I'm detecting goop and what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. That's the one thing I can say I really don't like about having to be a warrior.
Yeah, it's like you know, living around an outhouse all the time. And, you know, as long as you don't stir that stuff, you know, it's tolerable.
But all I have to do is be there, and it seems to be stirred.
Yeah.
It's like I'm there and I'm in that place and there's something going on, guess who gets to clean it up, or at least say somebody needs to clean the toilet. And it's always me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to say, if there's something that I do not like, it's finding dirty toilets. I'm not, you know, I really don't like that.
You're saying though, about being able to find the things wrong and things so too, that probably fits in with the other thing that we saw coming up in your reading that you seem to tune in on pretty much too, and it's the forgiveness. Because those two things kind of go together in terms of, you know, if you're the warrior and you find something wrong, you're seeking the justice and being able to fix it, then being able to figure out how to apply the forgiveness appropriately is the thing that counterbalances and helps to do that, maybe.
It does, but it's definitely not fun to find someone else's dirty toilet.
Yeah.
There's just no getting around this. It is not fun. And, you know, I wrote actually about being a spiritual warrior, and what I said is a spiritual warrior is one that stands in the gap between ordinary reality and spirit. A spiritual warrior is armed with self-knowledge, truth, prayer, discernment, and the ability to know truth from fiction. Oftentimes, spiritual warriors are reviled because they refuse to compromise truth to tickle people's ears with what they want to hear. They are lone voices crying in a wilderness of self-deception, false prophets, and false teachings. There are people who walk alone and are often misunderstood. They are charismatic, intense, with a passion for truth and discipline. They are the surgeons of the spiritual world, often perceiving truth with a clarity that is disconcerting. They can get to the heart of the matter with precision of mind that can be difficult to hear. They rarely mince words, but their purpose is not to wound with these words. While it may seem cold and harsh, their words are often prophetic in their warnings to abandon a certain path or mindset. And this is more or less what I feel in terms of, you know, what it means to be this warrior. It's not all fun and games. It's dead serious.
Yeah,
and
it
it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, you're a Scorpio, but you sound more like a... Is Sagittarius your rising sign?
No. I believe my rising sign might be a Libra.
Really?
I think. Huh. As far as I know, from what I remember my chart, and I don't remember specifically all of it, but I do remember they said it was a Libra in rising, and then something about five or six other Scorpio planets within my Scorpio, whatever it is. I'm not big on those things. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but that's as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Huh.
I don't know. I guess I'm just... I've never been one to put in a box easily when people, you know, try to put me in, well, you should be this way. I always seem to sort around those nice little boxes somehow.
Interesting.
Robin, was your grandfather a lot like that, too? Like, kind of had all these warrior characteristics, too? Or?
Oh, very much, and also my father, and my mother to some degree, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, I'm just thinking because there's probably other than just the family connection, there's probably a reason that your grandfather showed up at your near-death experience in terms of what you're doing now, too.
It could very well be. I mean, he was a very intense sort of man. He was very loving. He was darling, but he was intense, and he was the kind of person that he would look at you and you would know if you did something wrong. He never had to raise his voice. He would just give you this look. And you go, oh, my God, okay, I see the look. Okay, I'm sorry. And I think that he was that way. He was very much that way. He was a very powerful person in his own right.
Interesting. Where did you grow up?
New York City. You can't hear the twang?
Well,
I've tried to lose most of it, but I know I still have some of that twang.
Well, I was listening to the precision that you speak with, and I was thinking, wow, she's really verbal. But I lived on Long Island, you know, for 2.5 years, and you know, I know the accent. No, I never would have guessed. I wasn't real sure where you're from. I figured, you know, Ohio or something. Where are you living now?
I am actually living in Maryland, in Ellicott City.
Okay, that makes
but
sense.
But I've also, I've been in the theater when I was younger. I used to be in the theater.
Uh-huh.
I'm in musical comedy. I've had to learn to enunciate. I've had to learn to more or less try to get past whatever accents that you would have in order to be in the public speaking venue. That's probably why my speech is the way it is now, clear and concise and fairly accent-free. But there's still certain words. I still tend to say coffee or dog. Unless I'm thinking about it, then I'll say coffee or dog, but I have to think about it, you know.
That's interesting. So where were you in, let's say, the spring of 72?
1972. Let me think about this for a minute.
You would have been a senior in high school?
I would have been probably a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You living in the city then?
I was. I was living on 84th and Lexington. Well, I was living in two places. I actually lived with my maternal grandmother most of the time, and she was on 79th Street on the west end side of town near the school I went to. My parents lived on the east side on 84th Street in Lexington.
Okay,
but I was
so
mostly living with her, my grandmother.
60 blocks from Harlem. And the reason why I asked is the singing group I was with, we were in town, and... at Carnegie Hall, and they had me staying out in Manhattanville, And I was told, you know, take the local. Don't get on the express. And one night, you know, we had a night off, and they said, you know, go enjoy yourself. And I went down to Times Square and you know, took in a movie. But I took the express home. Ended up at Lenox Avenue and 142nd Street. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, and had to walk over a mile through CCNY. But, you know, I was quiet, and I wasn't with anybody. And I noticed there was a police car. It was making the block, following me to make sure I got to where I was going. And it didn't get any closer to me than a block. Yeah, it was interesting.
Well, you know, living in New York is always a thrill, no matter how you put it. It's definitely not for the weak and for the faint of heart.
No, you're not kidding.
But, yeah, I kind of went to school on 74th in Amsterdam. It was a private school called Baldwin Riverside High School. And I ended up staying mostly with my grandmother, who was probably one of these women who, if you were to define the word worry, her face would be the definition of the word.
Oh.
She just, chronic worrier. Lovely lady, but chronic worrier. And, you know, she more or less was around me and a big influence during my high school years. Very sweet lady. Miss her a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, certainly growing up in New York was a challenge.
Yeah, I lived out in Suffolk County. I lived in Northport, Centerport, and my dad was working for Grumman at Bath Beach during that period of time. And but by 70, we'd moved away to Michigan, and but that's an aerospace, so we lived all over the place.
Oh, really neat.
But so you hang around with Chickamauga people?
Yes. Right now, I'm involved with the First Nation Chickamauga. And before that, I've been in and out of different tribal groups throughout my years, depending on where I was and what I was doing.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, if you want to tell us about, you know, about that group or, you know, whatever, I want to, you know, talk about, this is your show, and, you know, talk about whatever you want to talk about. I try not to interrupt, but I end up doing a lot of it.
No, that's fine. I mean, the First Nation Chickamauga is a very wonderful group of some beautiful, beautiful people. And I've very much enjoyed meeting the people there. They are very kind-hearted, lovely people. One of my closest and dearest friends is also now my brother. He's nice enough to adopt me as part of his family, and he's an amazing man, and he's also the head warrior there, so he's just a fantastic person, and his wife is amazing. I love her to death. All good. You know, I'm finding myself just a part of a very unique opportunity to be part of this family. For the most part, you know, if you notice in my book, while there are some Native themes, I haven't really played on that so much because I wanted the book to speak for itself, and I didn't want, you know, to just play on that portion of my life, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
I kind of felt that, you know, that's why I didn't use a tribal name. That's why I kept it plain and simple, because I wanted it to speak to everybody. And you will find, quite a lot of these themes as you go through it that you will recognize if you are in the Native culture. You'll see them. But in writing the book, at least, I wanted to keep it more eclectic so that everybody could appreciate something in that book. Now, in the nation, what I've been doing is when I sell my books, I'm giving a certain portion or proceed to them to help, you know, for their kitty to do what they want with.
Right.
So if I'm selling my book right now for $20, I'll send a certain portion of that to them to help out with whatever that they need. You know, and there are a lot of needs right now that have to be met, so That's something that I think I can do as my book becomes more well-known, hopefully. And what I'm hoping is that it'll introduce people to their to a different mindset that they may not necessarily be familiar with, but in a way that they can stomach it.
Right, absolutely. So how long has First Nation Chickamauga been an enclave of a Native American church?
Well,
you know?
I know that the I'm not sure on how long this is going on, because I'm fairly new there, but I know that they've been working on it for quite an extensive period of time, and I've seen this probably in the last maybe 6 months, if I'm not mistaken, where they finally got all their papers together. They are registered with the Onak Church under Black Feathers. And they have their own little branch of Onak, apparently, that is strictly First Nation Chickamauga.
Right.
But I'm not quite sure of all the timing. I could be incorrect as to how new this is, but it does seem fairly new.
Yeah, for those people who don't know who the Chickamauga were, back in the 1770s, my great grandfather became a first beloved man of the Cherokee Nation, but this was after a lot of land cessions, a lot of land was given away to the whites, and Chief Drinking Canoe said, you know, basically, you know, we're melting like a snowball in the sun, and this has got to stop. And even though my ancestor Savinuka, now these guys were basically priests, high priest kind of figure, but they had the option to go on the warpath they want to. So he followed Dragon Canoe. But Dragon Canoe, and some of you have no doubt heard of Tecumseh. Tecumseh was, even though he wasn't a Cherokee, he married Dragon's daughter. And later on, Tecumseh tried to rebuild the Confederacy. But it was a Confederacy, a very large Confederacy of Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and a lot of other people. It had a northern wing and a southern wing. And had they been able to, they basically declared war on the 13 fires in 1776, and they during that period of time, there's a lot of trashy people. You know, they call them the scum of the Eastern Ocean, you know, and that was a lot of the kind of people we were running into, and there's a lot better people now, thank heavens, but you know, Cherokees, the leadership was basically Cherokee, and, you know, Cherokees loved white people. They liked the technology, they liked the things that they were bringing, but they just felt that we were just strangled, and Dragon Canoe was having none of it. And but there's a lot of good information up on the web about the Chickamauga Cherokee, and that's my ancestry. And Chief Miller and I have got some things in common, and some probably, you know, we're probably cousins, who knows, but that's who the Chickamauga are. And go ahead. I interrupted again and got tangential.
No. what you said was fine, you know, because I think it's good for people to understand a little bit about this. But what I see coming out of this is that this is a great thing, because being part of this church really helps us as a nation to be able to be recognized in some form or fashion, so we could do what we need to do as a group of individuals, whether it's our ceremonies or whatever it is, our religious ideals. What I like about this is that is the basis for why Onak exists. And We'll see. We'll see what happens. It's as I said, it's a fairly new thing, so I'm just learning myself about all of what it means. But it's very exciting, certainly.
This when the Native American Religious Freedom Act came into being, they created a class of person known as a Native Religious Practitioner, and there was very specific hoops you had to jump through to be one of these. So basically, when you get a card with ONAC or Oklahoma Native American Church, you are federally recognized as a Native Religious Practitioner. And
right, and you know, like anything else, there are some who are still, shall we say, in disagreement with this. There's a lot of controversy around this.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I need to explain that to you. And there are people who are very, very upset with this. I can only say I think time will tell where this goes and what this will mean for us as a people, whether, you know, this will stand the test of time. But I'm surely hoping that it does, because it offers so many opportunities that we wouldn't have had in any other way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and, well, most of the opposition has to do with bringing, you know, people that don't have Native ancestry, but it's a racist argument, because what ONAC is doing was done traditionally from the dawn of time. We're all about bringing in outcasts, and it was traditional to marry out and, you know, to keep the gene pool diverse. And, you know, what's going on now in a lot of places in Indian country is not representative of what Native people are all about. And it's, there's a lot of people out there that are just really ill in their minds about this. But that's, you know, they've been taught incorrectly, and we're all about pointing out that, well, you know, take, for example, people like Sam Houston. Sam didn't have a drop of Cherokee blood, but he became Speaker of the Cherokee Nation West. And when Chief Charles Jutlohi Kingfisher Rogers was a young man, he used to dream about, so, you know, he grew up in South Texas, so he used to dream about Sam Houston talking to him and teaching him things. And so this, you know, this was, you know, we adopted a lot of people, and the Iroquois adopted outsiders, Cherokees adopted outsiders. That's how they became a great nation. Now, particularly the Chickamauga, you know, we took in deserters, we took in black slaves, we took in people that just, you know, fed up with society, and you know, if you came in a good way with a good heart, you know, you became family after a year. It was official, and a lot of Native people have lost track of that. And that's really a lot of what we're all about.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hoping to see. And, you know, in many ways, again, if you read some of my stuff in my book, there's some alluding to some of this, of the nations waking up from a deep slumber and coming together in more unity. And there are definitely some allusions to this if you read my book. So you'll again, if you have any knowledge, you'll know what this is. You know, it's pretty much there and being alluded to. So I see this as part of this ongoing rebirth of our nations, of all of our nations, not just one nation, but of all of our nations. So I'm excited. You know, I'm not really one to speak for ONAC because I'm so new, but I can certainly say that I think it's an amazing time to be living in right now to see this coming to fruition.
Oh, yeah, it is. And,
you know, you talk about, you know, Matakia, yeah, well, we really, you know, we really go by that. You know, there's a lot of people, they'll say that, but they don't mean it, you know, that we're all related. And it's like Arvel Looking Horse said, it's time for us to grow together now and forgive but anyway, yeah.
And as you know, that it's an ongoing thing. You know, these things take time. It's not going to happen overnight. They take time. But yep. Being on the ground of this thing is, I think, absolutely phenomenal. So I'm excited to be a part of the beginning of a process. And I'm going to read something that I think you can resonate with here. Again, this is in my book. Brother Bear, stay with me. Be with me. Walk in front and be my guide. Safely see me through the dark until light shines my path. I call to you within my heart. It beats within your own. I hear the sound of your voice echoing, the ancient memories stirring my blood. May your medicine keep me strong. Let my moccasins always walk your path, the strength of your stride, keeping my feet straight on the path. Come to the Kiva fire and I will honor you, for I have roamed through the canyons and from this height I look down to the people. I looked up, for the time is coming, in the roar of a bear a message comes. Once again the elders will tell the stories, ancient ones within the stones call your medicine. From the four sacred places all will come to be known, wisdom and knowledge will flourish. That which was lost shall be found. Red and white as one united, take heed, this is the time to listen and the time to learn. Hear the beat of the people's feet echoing in the drums. War cries heard in the ears of the Creator, all singing one heart, one nation, many colors, within the roar of the mighty bear, walk with me, celebrate the rebirth of time. And that's how I see this. Through that poem, I see Onek and what we're doing as this coming up, and to be on the ground floor, to be birthing this thing. It's really quite amazing.
It is.
It's an honor.
Why don't we take a three-minute break, pause for the cause. I want to play Hoya Daxson's song, Way Before the Time of Towns. And it's a few seconds over 3 minutes. Then we'll come back and we'll take some calls and got about, you know, whatever you want to do. Sound good?
Sure. Sounds good.
Okay. Way Before the Time of Towns, Hoya Daxson.
Way before the time of towns, when men were wild and life was free, my father's father's great-grandfather's ancestors did see the morning star. Early morn for all mankind, the God of life and growing things, the rising sun and me. And way before the time of towns, when men carved tales on great stones, father's great-grandfather's ancestors did sing. looked down and gazed at them with open eyes, and what they saw was fair. They laughed at how the children looked bathing in the forest brook, and they were proud and they were kings, and love was everywhere.
Yeah, that's quite a song. Hey, listen, if you'd like to call in and have any questions, if you're listening, we're at 347-996-3318. And did you have any other thoughts? Anybody? Oh, I guess maybe Mark or Robin, are you there?
Yeah. I'm back.
Yeah. What do you think, Mark?
I think it's interesting. I think one of the other things before we wrap up, we ought, maybe I ought to ask her about is some of her dreams and the things she talked about, the weather changes and her premonitions and stuff like that. There's probably a lot of people listening that might be interested to hear
about. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Robin, you back yet? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
I'm right here. Well, you know, it's interesting. I had done a vision journey to nature, as I said. And I said, goodness, you know, what on earth is going on here? Because it was terrifying. You know, the scope of what's been going on, obviously, is very, very frightening. So I'm going to basically read you what was said to me. My question was, Mother Earth, the entire planet's weather system is out of kilter, and the scope of this is frightening. And at times it feels as though you're angry and lashing out. This was the reply. My children, you have it all wrong. I'm not lashing out at you in spite of all that you have done to deface and poison me. No, my children, you have it wrong. Yes, my body is responding to the damage you have done. Yes, the climate is warming. The polar caps are melting. Yes, there are stronger tornadoes. And yes, there are issues with rain, or lack of it, extreme heat, and other natural disasters. This is not because I'm lashing out, my dearest ones. Let us look for a moment at the process of cancer produced by cigarettes in your own bodies. When you choose to smoke, the lungs are damaged by cancer-producing agents. They are blackened and tarred from the cigarette, and that impedes their ability to deliver life-sustaining oxygen to vital cells that sustain your life. Eventually, the body responds by producing cancer cells. This is immunity gone wild, and it is the body's reaction to an unnatural and unhealthy product that should never have been there to begin with. Now you would say, does your body hate you in this case? Of course, it doesn't hate you. Is it lashing out? No. In essence, the body is trying to protect itself, but the mechanisms have been so damaged that instead of protecting, the body ends up attacking and killing itself. In the same manner, children, my body is responding to the damage you have done and continue to do. Unfortunately, I can't control the response of my body, and you are feeling the results. You can't poison waters of life I've given you, air that you breathe, ground that you were born from and end up going back to without consequence. This is not because I'm angry, but because my body is a living thing. It has its own ecosystems with checks and balances just as your body does. If you were to stop drinking water, you would die. If you were to stop eating, you would die. In the process of life, there are delicate systems that keep you alive, and if those processes are disturbed, then pandemonium and ultimately death is a result. These are choices, my children, your choices. You have made the choices. These are the consequences. Some have asked me, is this reversible? Yes, However, the time is fast approaching when it will not be reversible. Okay. And that was an important thing to hear. It's still reversible, but the time is fast approaching when it will not be. Just as people become terminal due to poisoning their bodies or neglecting their health, so am I fast becoming terminal. And once that point is reached, there is no return. There will be no coming back. And if there's a time to reverse this trend, it has to be before the damage is so extensive that no one will survive and no one or no life on earth will sustain itself as we know it. I have nurtured you children, but I am old and feeble from continued abuse. I am sick in body, and the poisons are rapidly diminishing my ability to recover, recoup, and fight back to health. I love you. I've given my body, my spirit, to ensure your continuance. I cry tears in acid rains that fall, bitter tears. For what have I done that I've deserved so little respect? I burn in the mounting heat as the ice caps melt, and so does my determination to recover. I rumble and move in tsunamis and earthquakes and see the devastation my body causes in the lives that it takes, and I cry, my children. I cry for you, for myself, and for all that I have done that goes unnoticed. Wake up, my children, before it is too late. I love you from Mother Earth. So in answer to your question about these changes, yes, they're happening. Yes, they're a problem. We still have the ability, at least from the time of this that was given to me, to turn this around. But the time is growing shorter and shorter. And if it goes untouched for too long, the situation will not be reversible, just as if you had a cancer and you didn't treat it in your body, and it ravaged your body and got into all your organs. Well, it's a little late to be doing something at that point. I hope that answers your question.
Yes.
Yeah, it would seem, you know, and it occurs to me, I think the solar system is, there's some kind of symbiotic thing going on, because the warming, when it was noticed, wasn't just Earth, it was the entire solar system, with very few exceptions. And when the Space Brothers started coming to us after we exploded the first nukes, you know, they said, hey, you're affecting us.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just going on here. What we're doing is not just the local neighborhood. We're somehow disrupting neighbors who are pretty far away.
That was not something I was aware of. That's interesting to know. Something I didn't know about.
Well, they've actually come in, and in several of the nuclear silos, they've basically taken control, like up, I think, in Minot. And, you know, they just took control of the whole nuclear base. And so I think some of the military guys working there started saying a little bit, and now I think recently in the last year or 2 years or something, they kind of got it to where those guys don't talk as much anymore. But yeah, apparently, like Blue Otter said, you know, things that we're doing, some of us the people doing it may or may not have any awareness of, you know, how it's affecting everybody else. They think, you know, well, the way we think is we can just do this. It's, you know, that's kind of like how we think of the plant. We can just do this and do this. It's like some of the natives say, you know, don't dig up this. Don't dig this out of the ground. Other people say, well, what's the problem with that? We can dig it in. It doesn't matter. They don't think about it, what the possible consequences or side effects of that are. Well, those consequences and side effects could extend way beyond what we consider normal boundaries and extend out in space and be evidently affecting other peoples and other planets and solar systems. And, you know, if they were doing that to us, well, we would claim the right to come and protect ourselves, wouldn't we?
You would think. I mean, I never really thought of what you're saying. But that's certainly a thought that I wouldn't have considered before today, that what we're doing not is only ramifications for us, but perhaps way beyond the things that we understand. So, good point.
Yeah.
I would have thought of that.
It doesn't matter who's in office, what party's in office. You know that we just broke the nuclear test ban treaty, tested another nuclear model of a weapon.
No, I didn't know this.
Yeah, see, the media doesn't tell you what's going on anymore, and that's something the founding fathers never figured would ever happen. They never figured the media would ever get tired of taking pot shots at politicians, but not since. I remember back in the 70s, you know, when they went after Nixon, and, they've been going after everybody, but here in the last 5-6 years, it's kind of like, oh, nobody could do any wrong, and, boy, there's a lot going on that people don't know.
No, it does seem as though there's a lot under the surface. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Good thought, yeah. Well, all the more reason to be considering, because basically, and I've heard this over and over, that in my visions and in my dreams, that the time has come, it's running out. It's running out. We've got to do something. If we're going to do something, we've got to do it soon.
Well,
when
you get Matt Drudge to tell people, hey, I have an escape plan. I mean, Matt Drudge.
Well, where the heck
Matt,
are you going to escape to? I mean, there's going to be no place to go.
It depends on, what you're trying to escape from. I mean, he's.
I mean, once we destroy our Earth, there's no place to run.
No, I'm talking about finances. He's talking about, have a plan for your finances and get out of the markets. And
but again, I mean, all that's going to be moot if our Earth itself is not going to sustain us. If we destroy that,
yeah.
What does it matter what money we have or where we think we're going to run?
I guarantee if there's a financial collapse, it's going to bring on war that much quicker. And I was told 2 weeks ago, flat out, Creator told me, war is coming. And, if we could keep the current administration, the lowest unemployment numbers were the day came into office, and they've been going downhill ever since. But, the Japanese tried the same Keynesian system for 10 years with absolutely no growth at all. So they just can't seem to figure it out. And I wish the guy well, but geez, they're just not doing so. We seem to be repeating all the same mistakes. I mean, we're going into what Europe figured out 10 years ago didn't work. So for some reason, we've got to go. It's like Benjamin Franklin said, only a fool learns from his own mistakes. And, oh, man.
Well, I have to wonder if the definition of insanity isn't doing the same thing and expecting different results here,
Well,
remember some of the Mayan and Hopi elders talk about the previous world cycles. And they say, they ended with greed and corruption. All the stuff you're saying about, how people treat the earth and treat each other and all these things we've been talking about, that's what they say. And so it's not like, they came out and tried to tell people. I think the message was so simple, a lot of people just couldn't understand it or what. But, I mean, that's where we're at. I mean, if you look at what the Hopi elders said about the end of the third world, the last previous world cycle. I mean, things were so bad then, what Blue Otter was saying about war, they were literally using something like we would say would be a UFO going in and attacking each other, getting in and out. The India Veda texts talk about the same type of stuff. I mean, war was so bad, and they were so greedy and corrupt. I mean, it was so out of control. According to the Hopi story, Creator said, that's it, that's enough. We're cutting their thread of time short. They will not even get their full cycle of time.
Well, we may, unfortunately, I don't know if it's going to happen in our lifetimes. It's hard to say. What I keep feeling, though, is the sense of things ratcheting up. But on the other hand, and this is just the more encouraging side, there are people who are waking up. All right. Whereas if you look back to, say, even 10 years, there seemed to be this lethargy. People were almost always asleep. More and more people are waking up, I think, to what could go on, what could happen, the more awful possibilities of doing the same thing the same ways. My hope is enough wake up to make a difference. And I think,
Robin,
you know,
what are some of the things or steps or ideas that you've thought of, or maybe it's even in your book, of things that some of the people waking up, what are some of the things, steps and things that you think that would be good to do to get people to unify and working together to make this change in a positive direction and actually not do the same thing over and over?
Well, really, the only thing you can do is to be the light in the darkness. Again, if we look at what it means, if you take one match in a black room, what happens? One match. Is that room black anymore? No. Okay, so if we take one match in a big room and it makes a difference, all you need to do is be a match. That's the one thing. If you want to make a difference, be a match. And use your light in whichever area you are best suited to. For me, it happens to be the public venue and talking about these things in writing. For you, it might be working with Greenpeace or some organization. Whatever you need to do, remember, your one light makes a huge difference.
Whatever
where
passion
darkness
is, yeah.
is, no light can be, and where light is, no darkness can remain. That is a universal law.
Yep. Yeah, and well, everybody grab your lighter and light up a fat one now.
and that's it. You just light your light in any way that you can.
Yep.
There are so many ways, you know, you can be green, quote-unquote, whether, you know, you drive your Prius or, you know, you recycle or you don't buy, you know, you don't use plastic bags. Or you'd be surprised what little differences can make between life and death. When you're talking about a patient being Mother Earth who says, I'm rapidly getting to the place where I am basically not going to recover. I'm at this place where it's going to overtake me. Then just you treat a patient with certain care, right? Not to set off whatever is in their body, right? So same thing with Mother Earth. What can you do? Be the light. Be the light. Choose to do something that makes a difference. And don't just say, well, it's only one person, because one match makes a difference. And if one match makes a difference, how much more do multiple matches make a difference? Those are the steps you can take. Even the littlest things make a big difference.
Yeah.
You know, learn what it means to be conservative with what you do to your mother, Earth. What does that mean? It doesn't mean using plastic, all right, and going to McDonald's with those plastic containers, whatever they are, you know, or plastic bags when you go to a Giant or the pharmacy or whatever. Be green. Make a smaller footprint.
That there's a huge number of younger people, you know, in their 20s or so. They're big surge trying to learn how to do their own natural and organic type farming and stuff.
Right. So, you know, and to continue that, those are the steps. When we talk about what does it mean, this is what it means. You put your money where your mouth is, you put your pedal to the metal, and you do what you can to make a difference and make a smaller footprint. And hopefully, if we all work to make a smaller footprint, at least we won't have a terminal Earth on our hands.
Yeah.
It's going to take time for it to recover, but at least it won't be terminal. So you have to think in small steps about what you can do in the here and now.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the worst case scenario, you know, hey, it's in the Bible. You know, most of the people, you know, will, you know, if you believe in Jesus, if you believe in the Bible, hey, most people are going to be dead, you know, by the time he gets here, if we don't turn things
well,
around.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't have to be
you
that
you read
way.
That stuff, you can get pretty darn scared. You start talking about revelations and stuff.
Yeah.
Frightening. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, even if it's an allegory, it's still frightening. The scope of what it's talking about is terrifying. So what I say is, what can we do that's faith-building and that's edifying and that's going to make a good difference? What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
What
even if,
are we going to do?
Even if, I mean, you know, we're all spirit, we live forever. And let's say the worst thing does happen. You know, you take humans off the planet and, you know, for several thousand years and, you know, get a chance to heal itself. And this, you know, ask any rabbi, they'll tell you this has happened many times before. But at least, you know, the creator can't point the finger at us and say, what were you doing when the planet was dying? You know?
Well, exactly. What were you doing? And that's why in my book I keep stressing these little things. What does it mean to be the light? What are you choosing to do? What is your relationship with the Creator, with Spirit? What does it mean to be sensitive to nature? And, you know, in my book, there's a lot of little stories that I've told. For example, there's Tree People Speak and stories from Grandmother Oak and stories from Grandfather Pine that, you know, where literally I was talking to a tree. Some people might say, boy, you talk about a tree hugger. That takes it to a new level. But, you know, if you're willing to listen, the stories that some of these trees tell is quite fascinating and wonderful. You know,
that's true.
And in one of my things is Tree People Speak. And this was one of the trees that I was literally sitting under the roots, and this is the song I heard in its leaves. And I know, you know, you can call me nutty. That's okay. I've been called worse. But this is what I heard. I stand in silence, but my voice is in my leaves. They sing with the wind, and they have stories to tell if you will but listen. I am tree who stands. My boughs are connection to Father Sky, and my roots are deep in the love of Mother Earth. I am that which balances and connects us to both realms of heaven and earth. Come lean by my body and let me balance you. Let me help you remember your connection to our sacred Mother Earth and to Father Sky. I bring up that which Mother Earth gives, that which is sustenance and life. And in turn, I breathe out life to the four-legged ones that surround me. Because of me, the air you breathe is balanced. And it goes on. I won't read the whole thing, but the point is that we need to open our ears, both physically and spiritually, to our environment and to our mother, to Pachamama, to Gaia, to Mother Earth, to listen to what is being said. That's how we make a difference.
That's right. Well, believe it or not, we have to go. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show and letting me talk about my book and all the other wonderful, interesting things we've managed to talk about.
You bet. And I'll tell you.
For my book, just if I may, I've got 30 physical copies left because right now the book is not in print as it's being changed over to the new format. The 30 physical copies, you can contact me at robin.littlefeather@gmail.com. They're $20 plus shipping. There are 30 copies left if anyone's interested in the book. The newer book should be out shortly. I couldn't tell you when yet. And if you go to Amazon, there is an e-book under the Heart Song of Anekahi.
Very good. Very good. And I'll get with you later about how to grab an MP3 of the show, okay?
Sounds wonderful.
Very good. Good night, folks. Bye-bye now.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Though the path is not easy, I'm grateful for this life, for the chance
to behold your face again. When my sacred journey's over, when it all comes to an end, I'll enter the next life to live again.
As Blue Water, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?